Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the...
For more than two decades now, Dr. Kathleen Hartford has treated and nurtured thousands of individuals through her integrated wellness approaches. And as patients reclaim their health, she coaches them to how to maintain their youthful vitality with practical guidance on nutrition, exercise, and stress management. She's the author of Fit, Fun, and Fabulous at Any Age, which along with its companion journal and cookbook creates a lifestyle approach that reverses the biomarkings of aging. She's the president and founder of Health Pyramid Longevity and Vitality Center in the Pittsburgh suburb of Natrona Heights in Pennsylvania. She's also the founder and the philanthropically based sister support organization, and this list goes on. And let us say, Kathleen, I welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, and I was gonna go farther with your bio, but then I was gonna ask you, what do you do in your spare time?
You know, I ride horses. In fact, I just got off a horse, and my goodness, it got dark very quickly. But no, I do have spare time. It's about focus, right? You should know. I'm sure you keep many balls in the air.
Oh, absolutely. They just keep flying. I'm an old horse guy. I spent, I was in, Fairbanks, Alaska for almost 23 years, and they had horses up there. And I'll tell you what, that's a world that unless you've been exposed to it, the people don't know how giving that is.
Oh, yeah.
You get so much
wonderful.
Out of it.
Horses are just very, very special. Very
the only
special.
Thing I didn't like about it, at 40 below zero, you still had to go out and give them water and feed them in the morning.
Oh yeah, they're food in and whatever out. You know, they are very high demand, but they give you so much in return.
Ah, no question. Let's talk about health for a minute. Health is always going to be health no matter where you are, who you are, or what geographic location you're in. But health has taken on a different definition over the years, and we're starting to move away from allopathic medicine. Not that there's not a place for it. But we're looking at the alternatives today. We're looking at what truly gets a person healthy. So let's take you all the way back for you. Kathleen, what was it for you in your life that triggered you to say, health is where it's at for me. This is my focus. This is who I am.
Yeah, when I was in my early 20s, I was actually with a Fortune 500 company. I graduated from the University of Pittsburgh and went with this company. And I was in a very minor fender bender. And, my head actually hit the window and created a misalignment. And the next thing I knew, I had the worst low back pain that one can imagine. And I, went around the medical route for about 6 months. And then finally one of the secretaries suggested I perhaps see a chiropractor, and I did that. And I was about 70% better after just one adjustment. And I was upset. I was angry. I was like, how could nobody tell me this? You know, I'd been under care of very highly qualified people for a long time. And the friend that I was with actually looked into chiropractic. He said, I'm going to school. I've never seen anything like this. And I was going to go on and get my MBA, and my nickname is Hart for Hartford. And he said, Hart, you got to come down here. You got to hear what chiropractic is truly about, the philosophical basis of chiropractic. And I went down, and I was just so taken by it all. I said, this is my life. And, So I became a chiropractor. And actually, Michael is a straight chiropractor, which means, we were just adjusting the spine, very specific adjusting, but sticking with the spine. And then my husband was in a plane crash. And had a very serious head injury. And with the head injury, what I've learned about medicine, and it's so interesting that you say, And one of the things that, people need to understand is that health is more than just medicine. In other words, it doesn't fall just into that medical paradigm. And I realized very quickly, he was in a coma for several weeks, and I realized that medicine could keep him alive, that medicine was not going to return him to his highest level of function. And so I just became a seeker of information from biochemistry. You know, I needed to know what can heal the brain. They say the brain can't heal, but we can create new neurons. So from biochemistry to the emotional aspect to, you know, the functionality of, you know, physical therapy, things like that, I just became a real seeker of knowledge. And the first thing the doctor, the neurosurgeon said to me was, find a home for your husband. He's never coming back. And I said, you keep him alive and I'll take it from there. And I did. And he's a fully functioning chiropractor. And, you know, things worked out well. And it's just such a shame, because if I didn't know what I knew and if I didn't have great belief that where there's life, there's hope, I probably would have put him in a home and just left him there. So, yeah, so health, when it, you know, health is such a word that we use so readily. But, you know, health really is a gift that serves you every day of your life. And it's something that you get to contribute to, you get to create.
Oh, sure. By the way, we are totally responsible for it. I want to talk about chiropractic for a moment. And let me say this before, and I am not a clinician. But over the years, this is what I've, the information that I've garnered when you really come down to it. The spine in and of itself, you know, that houses your immune system and everything else, you know, that area around it. And it's the immune system that's really going to make you healthy or unhealthy. And what occurs is there's connections and disconnections. When your spine is off, there is a disconnect. And the chemicals, we are an electrochemical factory from the brain all the way down. And when the spine is out of adjustment, there's a disconnect. And the chemicals that need to go to the place to make you function the way you're supposed to don't get to get there. So when you balance it, all of a sudden things start to flow. And I really, truly believe beyond the adjustment in and of itself, you are dealing with neuroscience. And neuroscience has to do with emotions. Emotions has to do with behavior. And it's collectively, your entire being can sit in your spine.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just neuroscience. It's also epigenetics. You know, they're finding that we used to believe that genetics defined who we were and what would happen to us. And what we're finding is, no, we pretty much determine our genetic expression. So when we're looking at genetics now, it's simply a blueprint that we get to decide which way we take that blueprint. So this is a very exciting time, Michael, when it comes to health, because what we're finding is, as you just said, you know, we really define, our health is really a sum of our choices. You know, the foods we eat, the thoughts we think, you know, whether or not we choose to support our bodies with chiropractic or acupuncture. You know, medicine is a diagnosis and treatment of disease, and they're good at diagnosing disease. But
sure.
When it comes to health, you really have to look at what enhances your health, because everything is either going to enhance your health or diminish your health. And so we always want to be looking for, what are those health-enhancing choices that I can participate in?
Yeah, well, let's take it the step farther the way that you do it. And I think, Kathleen, it's extremely important. You go to the doctor's office, the doctor diagnoses you, gives you a pill, and you go feel better down the road. Most of the time, the pill takes care of the symptom, doesn't really hit the problem, and then the problem creeps back. But that said, then you get left alone. I like the way you follow up with it. You start the process of healing. Then, after they reclaim their health, you work on them to maintain their health. Then you work on exercise. Then you work on nutrition and stress management. And nutrition in and of itself, most people go on a diet, quote unquote, if they're overweight. It's not a diet. It's nutrition that's the key word. And I really believe in my heart of hearts, based on what you take in is how the outcome of your physical being is going to be and your mental and emotional being.
Right, and even beyond that, I mean, it's not diet as such. It really is a lifestyle. You know, the book Fit, Fun, and Fabulous at Any Age is really a lifestyle that will allow you to be fit, have fun, and have a fabulous life. But the reason that, you know, I really want to stress that it's a lifestyle is because most of the people that I see that are truly obese or suffering with diabetes, especially the diseases of aging, and what the program does is it stops accelerated aging and reverses that process. You know, Mike, we have ways ways to determine your biological age. In other words, your cellular age. Your age should always be younger. Your biological age should always be younger than your chronological age. Unfortunately, what we find is that we're in this rapid, accelerated aging process, especially in our country, which leads to, you know, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, even over 80% of our cancers are lifestyle related. The good news about that is if it's lifestyle related, then you have power, you have control over that. So we utilize foods to enhance our health. Once our body has what it needs, once the neurological system, as you said, that, you know, the electrical chemical system is balanced, once the body is able to communicate effectively with every cell, tissue, and organ, and then we give it all the building blocks that it needs, then the body heals itself. I mean, it's not rocket science. It's real. It happens every day. There isn't any scientist in the world that could take a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and make new eye cells. But yet our kids get that happening every single day. And the power of the body is just so exciting for me. I mean, that's where, you know, healing really becomes juicy, is that where there's life, there's hope. So let's look at your body. Let's find out what the blocks are to your healthful expression. Let's remove those blocks. Let's give you what you need, and then let's let your body heal itself and become vibrant.
Oh, and by the way, mindset has a tremendous amount to do with it. I don't want to get off focus with this, but just a very quick one. 13 years ago, I had a debilitating disease, and I had to have an operation. So I have stayed fit all my life, and I thought, okay, if I've got to have an operation, I'm going to get in the best physical condition I can get in to help me through this thing. So I'm sitting there I'm running around the hills, but then I'm sitting there one day in the garage, and I'm on a stationary bicycle. And I'm pedaling away, and I'm sweating, and then the thought hit me. I made it, Kathleen, I made it okay to die. I didn't say I wanted to die, but I made it okay right. to die. The minute that happened, the stress left, and I really believe at that stage of the game, my immune system kicked back in, and that in and of itself probably saved me.
Oh, absolutely. You know, my second book is actually titled Ramblings of a Mad Woman, Losing Your Mind and Finding Yourself. And one of the things that I really stress in that book is that you have to be okay with where you are. You know, we live our entire life pushing against what is. The truth of the matter is, it is what it is. And when you finally, you know, sort of gave yourself over to this is what is, and I'm not going to fight it, but I'm going to take care of myself, then your body could relax. It stops producing cortisol. It stops diminishing the immune response. I mean, stress is so detrimental to our body. The concept of fighting against something is so detrimental to our body. That's why I call my program a healthy aging program rather than an anti-aging program. I don't want to be anti-anything. I want to be for health. I want to be for life. I want to be for vitality. And that's about saying, I know where I am right now, but I also know where I can be. And just like you, just giving it up and allowing your body to, you know, get rid of that resistant energy and start toward healing energy. It's just so important, and that's a great example, Mike.
And give you a great analogy. You're body surfing down a river, and there is a big stone in the middle of the river. Now, if you resist the current, you're going to insert yourself into the stone. But if you just kind of relax and go with the flow of the current, you're going to go around the stone. And I think that's what life can be like. Too many people resist. And if you resist, you're going to slam right into that stone.
Absolutely. And what you're doing to yourself biochemically, you know, as you said, we're an electrical chemical, you know, body here that's functioning all the time. What you do to yourself biochemically when you resist, when you're under chronic stress, when you, you know, rather than putting together strategic steps to move forward, you sort of sit in the mess of life. Because life can be very messy. It is so detrimental to your body, and it depletes your energy stores. So rather, what we do with people is we say, you know, let's see where we are and let's get okay with that. And I use this great technique called neuroemotional technique to help people understand the emotional aspect of their life and how that's playing a role. And once people start to have those aha moments, then they can start to see what you just described, the flow of life. Because life flows, life moves. I mean, look, we're going to get older. You know, the program isn't going to stop aging. You know, we're going to get older. I'm 54 years old, but my biological age is still in early 30s, and I want to keep it that way, if not younger. So once we start to understand, you know, the patterns, the mind patterns that sort of have us resisting or keep us stuck in a certain way of being, then we can start to breathe a little bit. Then we can start to allow the flow to occur. And then we can look for those places where we do have power and insert ourselves in those places and let go of the places that we really can't change.
Sure. And by the way, we're just about out of time, Kathleen, but one of the things I do in the morning when I first get up, I open my eyes and I'll sit up in bed and I'll think, okay, dopamine, do your stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dopamine is a wonderful, wonderful little biochemical that it's another thing to really stress here is that your body is a chemical manufacturing facility and it makes everything you need. So look for what is blocking it. Is your diet, such as, you know, excess sugar, is that creating, you know, sort of those lulls that you get during the day? We really want to look at serotonin production. We really want to understand what dopamine does. We really want to understand how stress affects cortisol levels. And that's what we try to point out in the book. In other words, you try to help people to be more empowered because, you know, in my practice, I can only reach so many people a day. But with a book, with the program, with the website, and with conversations like we're having here, we can reach thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people, and truly make a difference in their life. And that's what I'm committed to.
I hear you loud and clear. Kathleen, we're out of time. Let me ask you this. Website we can find you at, buy the books, and find out about what you're doing.
Oh, it's a fun site, too. I think people will enjoy it. It's www.drhartford, just like Connecticut, drhartford.com. And when you go to the website, there are a couple of things. If you choose to sign up for a newsletter, I'm going to immediately send you a white page outlining what a fit, fun, and fabulous day looks like so you can begin that journey to creating a fabulous life. Also, if you look at the program, you say, you know what, I want to get started now, I'm going to give you a free coaching session so you can get started right now. Now, order that kit and we'll immediately get in touch with you and we'll set up a time that we can start to coach you if that's what you choose to do, but at least get you those, you know, first few days so that you know exactly what it is that sort of helps to enhance this process. So if you go to the website again, drhartford.com, you'll see many things. One of the most exciting things you'll see, you know, like so many people just have, you know, they're just not comfortable going to a gym. So what we have there, we have a YouTube channel for exercise, and it's actually the director of fitness at University of Carnegie. So University of Carnegie is a pretty big center out here in Pittsburgh, and Carnegie University has some wonderful fitness programs. We've got the director of fitness doing level one and level two exercise for people that you can do right in your living room. We want to support you. So, you know, we just suggest just take advantage of everything that we have going on there. This white paper will give you an idea of what the program is about. Getting your starter kit will get you a free coaching session, and we'll just take it from there and get you started on exercise, and, you know, we're good to go.
By the way, I glanced at the site real quick before the show. Did I see products on the site?
Yes, there are products in the site. We have actually two different sections. We're updating our natural pharmacy with all of our products, but what you'll find there is the starter kit, which is going to be an anti-inflammatory food because all of our disease processes are based in inflammation. An anti-inflammatory medical food, it will give you the results in 90 days, Michael, that would take you 2 years to get if you're using diet alone, a Mediterranean diet alone. So that's exciting. But then we add magnesium to make sure all those nutrients get through your cell wall, and we add those essential fatty acids because if you're not getting healthy fats in your system, your body won't let go of fat. And we have people that have lost 150 pounds of fat on this program. So it's a very, very effective approach, and it's a very, very health-supportive approach. You're not going to turn around and put the weight back on with this program because you're going to understand what it is that causes this weight gain that so many people suffer with and that leads to so many diseases of aging. Like I said, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, osteoporosis, and most of our cancers.
Well, okay, we're out of time, but I want to thank you so much for being here. And one real quick question, if I took that program and reversed it, can I gain weight?
No, but if we did some nice lean muscle work, we could do that.
I've been doing that for 50 years. Kathleen, hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you too, Mike, and you have a wonderful night.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Desert awaits it, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there, when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. Michelle Rickman is with us. 101 Great Ways to Enhance Your Career. She's the co-author, and we're going to do the job tip of the week. And Michelle, hey, well, welcome back. Did I lose you, Michelle?
I'm here.
Oh, good. I was so I was hiding behind the door. I didn't know if you could hear me or not.
Now I'm here.
How are you?
Hi from me.
Okay. By the way, the shark said to say hello to you.
Ah, I love the shark.
She's a cutie, isn't she?
She absolutely is.
Yeah. No, I talked to her the other night, and she said she had you on her show, and she just loved it.
Yeah, we had a very good segment. Very enjoyable. Yeah.
That's great. Now, by the way, many people today, they've got to return back to the workforce. One of the reasons is because of the economy. And now, in many cases, it's going to take those two paychecks to be able to make a household happen. Returning back to the workforce, a lot of people left it, and it's completely different than it was when they left it. What kind of changes are we seeing where somebody's got to adjust themselves to it?
Well, the search is a very different kind of search, where people that are returning to the workforce, you know, they were used to, let's say, 15, 20 years ago, they were looking for a job, they put together a resume, they looked in the New York Times or the want ads, and they put their resume out to a whole bunch of headhunters. Then they went and they looked for a position, and that's just not the way it works today. Today's job search is really completely strategic, very targeted, and very competitive, certainly much more competitive than it was back then.
No question. But what do we have to know? And, you know, especially in a resume, there's something called a value proposition when somebody's in business. What makes you different than everybody else out in the street? What makes you different from your competition? That also has to show up in a resume, too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons that when you're writing a resume, you don't write an objective. An objective states, as we were taught many, many years ago, that the first thing that goes on your resume is an objective statement. And what is an objective statement? It says, I want this. And it's usually pretty generic. I want to be in a company that is fast and forward-thinking, that offers career growth and opportunity. Okay, well, how many people can say that? It's something that you can cut and paste and put on anybody's resume.
Sure.
But even going beyond that, it's completely applicant-centric. It's I. And quite frankly, the way today's job force works, nobody cares what you want. Employers absolutely do not care that you want to be part of an organization, you know, that's profitable and growing. They want to know, what do you have to offer me? What do you bring to the table? And that's what goes in the front. In the very beginning is your profile. your profile that states who you are, what's unique, what do you bring to the table, what do you offer. And you really need to brand yourself and be very, very, you know, cognizant of the fact that you are a product and you need to sell yourself, and you need to put that right up front. Here's what makes me different.
And so the magic, really, from what I'm hearing, is when the shift happens, when the shift goes from you to them. And it's not about you. It's about what you can do for them. And I think there's so many people who do not get that.
No, no. And unfortunately, it seems that a lot of people that are out there are getting advice from different resources. You know, there's still this old mentality where people will say, oh, well, you have to have an objective statement. And it's just not, it does not work. Objective statements, if ever used, I don't personally ever use them. I do have colleagues that will use them for, let's say, an entry-level college graduate or sometimes in a career transition, but I still don't believe that that's the best way to position it. If you're in a career transition, such as a person who's returning to work, what you can do is you can put up on top a header that would have a career target. So, for example, if I had, let's say, a return-to-work mom, and she's looking to get into an administrative position, I could put career target, administrative support, and then put a profile that describes that candidate and what that candidate brings to the table.
That makes sense. By the way, there was in our interviews, the some that we've done, did I ever tell you, and by the way, when I say this, you've got to promise not to tell anybody about what I'm going to tell you next. This is our secret.
Our secret. I don't say a word.
Okay, good. Okay. This one we don't tell anybody. This is the, did I ever tell you about my used car experience?
No, I haven't heard that.
Oh, this was good. Okay, remember, this is the one we don't tell anybody, that I was a used car salesman for one summer. That actually what happened was, I did 25, 30 years ago, I got to a point where I needed to make some extra money. And I looked in the paper, and I'm looking for some part-time stuff, something to do during the summertime. And I saw this ad for a used car salesman. I said, nah, I can't do that. I just can't do that. So I'm driving down the street, and it wasn't me, but it was the car that turned into the lot. And I ended up in the lot, and I walked in, and the guy looked at me, and he said, what do you know about selling cars? And I said, nothing, but I can sell anything. He said, we start at 10 in the morning. I said, thanks, and I saw him, and had a great summer. But the point is, it was about him. It wasn't, I can. Well, I knew what he wanted. What he wanted was someone to produce sales for those automobiles. That's all he was interested in, and that's all I had to say.
Yeah, and what's interesting, and when, particularly when you're returning to work, you need to kind of go through your background and see what kinds of things do you have, what kind of skills do you have that are transferable that will fit into whatever the job market is demanding. So if you're looking for a specific type of position, it could be, working in an office. Or maybe it is going back and returning to a field that you were in 10 to 15 years ago. You really have to have a good understanding of what they are looking for. And then take the experiences that you've had over the years that you have been out of the workforce and see how you can kind of, I don't want to use the word manipulate, because everything that you put on a resume must be true, but we want to be able to take that information and apply it and show how it's transferable. I'll tell you a secret, but we can't tell anyone.
I won't tell. This is our secret. Oh, by the way.
You got to promise. I was singing Telegram at one point as a way to make a little extra money when I was first starting out in my career.
That's funny.
But you can't tell.
I wouldn't tell anybody. It's our secret.
Know.
I'll carry it to the grave.
There are most likely, if I was a return to work person and I needed to kind of repackage my resume towards something that I would be going for now, I still might be able to find skills from that type of a position that would fit, whether they were customer service skills or relationship building skills, or the ability to make people laugh, create a happy environment, or you know, contribute to a positive workforce. And you know, so you have to be creative. You have to find, well, what do I have, and how do I make that fit into what they are looking for? And it's really important to really go through the jobs that are out there so that you do have a good understanding of what they're looking for, so that when you are crafting your marketing materials for a job search, you're including, you know, whatever's going to be applicable to finding that position.
Yeah, by the way, no question, and I really believe in my heart of hearts, and everything you're saying is just spot on, but we're in trouble. Radio Susie heard what you did. Now I can't keep it a secret anymore.
Oh, no.
She got us.
No.
She got us. Okay.
All right. But
when you really come down to it, if somebody would just take the time and whatever industry that they're going to go after and find out what it is about that industry, what is that industry looking for? What's the guts of the industry? What propels it? What motivates it? What keeps it going forward? And that, knowing that going in, and then you tie your resume to it, then all of a sudden you got a little bit of a step up over everybody else.
Right. It's really about doing your homework. You have to do your homework. You have to know what the demand is so that you can speak specifically to that demand and show how you can be a contributing, a positive contribution to that organization.
No question about it. Now, interview don'ts. What is it that I should not do in an interview now that I'm going to have to go out and be a used car salesman again?
One of the things that I find when I'm coaching people that are actually going back into the workforce and haven't interviewed in a long time is people will go in and tell their life story. So, for example, again, all about me, me, me. So I've been out of the workforce for 10 years, and I go into my whole story of, well, I went out on maternity leave, and you know, I've been raising my children, and I've been doing little part-time work, and then I got divorced, and now I'm back into a position where I need to support myself, and you know, whatever that whole story is, they don't want to hear it. They just want to know, again, what can you do for me?
Yeah. How do you increase my bottom line? Yeah, how do you increase my bottom line in whatever department
we put
you in?
How are you going to contribute? How are you going to have a positive impact on my organization?
No, and by the way,
the positive stuff, it's got to be kept out of the interview. Nobody wants to know that you were, you know, taking care of grandma. Nobody wants to know that you raised, you know, three kids. Nobody wants to know that, you know, now you're in a position that you're going to be the sole breadwinner. Keep the story out of it and come in and just hard hitting, here's what I have to offer and here's what I can do for you.
You know, this reminds me, I think, Michelle, over my entire life, I've probably applied for three jobs, maybe possibly four. But I was 17 years old and, no, I was 18 years old. I came back out of the military and I went to work for this organization. Now I'm 18, 19 years old. And I'm all night long from 5 to 12 o'clock at night. There's these wheels that come down this assembly line, and they pick the wheel up off the whatever it was, and then stick it on the conveyor belt. And I tell you what, I was strong, but that's all I was doing. And at 19, 20 years old, whatever it was, this was not a good social life. So I walked into the office one day, and I said, can I speak to somebody? I want to get a different job here. So they brought me into the guy's office, and he looked at me and he said, what can I help you? He said, yeah. I said, yeah. I said, I want to get on daytime, and I want a different job. And he said, how long you been here? I said, a month. And after he stopped laughing, I walked out of the office. Now I walked over to the door. I put my hand on the door. I turned around and I looked at him and I said, I can offer this company something. There's more to me than what's sitting here. And in some way, I know I can help out here. And he looked at me and he said, come back tomorrow. So I checked around. And when I came back the next day, they had a job. They had an opening in the chem lab. And he said, have you ever had chemistry? I said, yeah, in high school. You know, I got a D in it. And by the time I met the chemical engineer, we talked. Next thing I know, I got a job. It's three times the money hourly. And I was there for about 3 years. But the key was, it was, what can you do for us? And that's what it was.
Right. And I think you're bringing up a good point as well, that you went in with some confidence also, and you, by saying, I know that I can contribute, and I know that there's more for me here. And I think that that's another very important thing for people that are returning to the workforce to understand and to keep in mind, because a lot of people get shaken because they're nervous, because they haven't done it in so long, because it's been 15 years since they've been on an interview, and they lose that confidence. And you need to be confident. You need to be able to brag. It's not the time to be shy, and it's not the time to be modest. You need to be able to brag. Here's what I am. Here's what I have to offer. And I definitely recommend for people that need practice with that, finding themselves a career coach, practicing. Practice makes perfect.
Yeah, no, I hear you loud and clear. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Website we can find you at?
I am at RicklandResources.com. That's RIKLAN resources.com.
Michelle, it's been wonderful as usual, and we will see you next week. I'll keep your secret. You keep mine.
Absolutely. Take care, Michael.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Last forever, and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, that told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on, I like that one too, Dresser After Dark. Edward Franz with us, received his AB from Princeton University and his MA and PhD from the University of Wisconsin. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Indianapolis, explores such questions in his new book, The Door of Hope, Republican Presidents and the First Southern Strategy, 1877 to 1933, and it was published by the University Press of Florida. And let us say, hi, Dr. Franz, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael Ray, how are you?
Oh, good, Ted. I'm glad you're here. You know, we have so much confusion over history when you deal with the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, and it's almost as though the roles got reversed as years went on. It seems as though the Republican Party were staunch. I say we because I'm a Republican, but we're staunch and the Democratic Party isn't, and they open things up. But not that many people know that Martin Luther King happened to have been a Republican. So I really believe that it's the history that gives us the grounding and the foundation of who we really are and what we're about. And I don't think most people have any idea.
I couldn't agree with you more, which is why it's good to come on shows like yours and try to elucidate a little bit more about the past. And certainly the shift that you just talked about with Dr. King and his family is one that many families made sometime not all that long ago within a lot of people's memories. And that's part of what makes this whole thing just so fascinating, I think.
And Ted, what got you interested in it? I mean, there must have been something that pressed your buttons and said, I need to research this. I need to get into this and look at the history and bring it to the fore.
Well, I'm one of those strange people who's always been interested in the past in some reason, in some ways, and so I think that for me, the interest in this story is one that is kind of autobiographical and gets into my roots growing up in Ohio, and I like to describe many of the presidents who come from the Buckeye State as being the obscure bearded presidents that very few people outside of their families actually recognize were presidents. And so that was a part of it. The issues of race, which I see played out in my life, was a part of it. And then, I've always been interested in politics. Those three intersected, and the result is this book, I guess.
You know, when you come down to it, if you go back into history, it seems as though the Republican Party early on, with the Emancipation Proclamation, et cetera, that was the popular party for the white Southerners. The Democratic Party was the civil rights movement and so on and so forth. But at the same time, there was a tremendous amount of black people that belonged to the Republican Party. And I think that little point in history seems to get left out most of the time.
Well, as a matter of fact, and most of this part of my study, which starts in 1877 and then ends in 1933, during that entire time, blacks who could vote, and that's, by the end of the study, a distinct minority, if they could vote, they voted Republican almost exclusively. And that was mainly because the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln, the party of emancipation, as you said. And more than anything else, the Democratic Party during that period, again, ending in 1933, was the party of secession, the party of the Deep South, and of some urban areas. But, the memory of the Civil War, it was so prominent, both for African Americans and for white Southerners, that continued to be a touchstone for them long after the war itself was over.
Yeah, but the slavery issue during the war was not really the main issue of the war. It was a side issue. The main issue of the war was really we're talking about money, we're talking about business, and we're talking about the two sides fighting each other, and the Republican quote unquote the blue side of it came from the dollars, the manufacturing, and so on and so forth. And I think that's where the real battle was. And the slavery was an important issue, but it was a second issue. It didn't hold the prominence the first issue held.
Well, I would tend to argue the opposite, but you're entitled to your opinion. I think at the root of a lot of those business interests.
Ted, I'll go with your opinion because you're the historian. This is based on information I've heard over the years.
Well, I think at the root of it, certainly most of the stuff that I've read would suggest to you, Michael Ray, I don't expect it to suggest to everybody, but would suggest to me that at the core, a lot of these business issues, really at the core of it, once you kind of scratched over there, all these issues and prerogatives that white Southerners wanted to protect were, one degree of separation, maybe 2 degrees at most, removed from power, privileges, rights that they got as slaveholders. And, one of the things that I think what you may have heard in the past is, one of the things is the average white Southerner did not, in fact, own slaves, and that is true. And so you start getting into these very complicated ideological reasons for why people fought. But the bulk of the stuff that I've read would suggest that secession was a move to preserve a way of life. That Southern way of life had slavery really as its foundation. Thus, the war did not start as a war to end slavery. It transformed itself into that under the Republican Party and Abraham Lincoln, but that was not its root cause in the North. It was the preservation of the Union. And then that transformation, for some, took place midway through the war. I would argue for many others, especially in the Midwest, where I am from and currently live, there were a number of white Midwesterners who never believed that the war was a war to end slavery. But there were a number of others, if you look at their diaries, their letters, who began to see that throughout the war, and that's what just makes it so fascinating.
Now, by the way, if that most people were schooled in the way that you were schooled, in the history that you were schooled in, do you think we would have the problems that we have today? Because there's still a tremendous amount of separation, and a lot of it falls right back to, you know, a couple hundred years ago when slavery was really prominent. Do we really have the right information, and are we battling about the right things?
Well, I don't think we're battling about the right things at all, and that's probably, you know, 2 other hours in and on of itself. I mean, I think both parties, mainstream media, tend to pick up, especially with a 24-hour news cycle, tend to pick up obscure kind of side issues, items that are going to get attention at that moment. And the big picture items, I think, largely get pushed aside. I think as far as the historical record, I would argue that with all of the authors out there, with the accessibility of the works on the Internet, it's not for a lack of opportunity that Americans, if we're talking in the political context here, or anybody in the world is who has Internet access, is lacking. In the United States, I would say one of the things is, especially in the last 20 years, people have gotten to choose the side that they want to hear. And there are all kinds of studies. Mine is not one of them, but there are all kinds of studies that would suggest people hear and watch only what they want to watch, and therefore don't have to be exposed to ideas different than their own, whether those are about current events or the past.
See, the interesting point was, and I think if you go to the South, I was brought up in the born early 40s. I was brought up in the 50s. When I graduated high school, June 18, 1960, and June 21st, 1960, I was standing tall at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot in San Diego, California. Now, being from Los Angeles, there was prejudice. There's always been, but I really didn't get exposed to it as a kid compared to what it really was in the South. And I remember standing, in those days I smoked, we were after chow, we were standing there, and I had a couple friends of mine who were Texans, and we were having a cigarette, and one guy was really quiet. And I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "Nothing." I said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "You know, if my daddy knew that I had lunch with the N-word, he said he'd kill me." And that was the first time that I actually saw it. And it seems as though that the problems were predominantly in the South. And that's where, and then it became not only ideology, but then it got to be used as a political football, something to be used to garner votes and so on and so forth. And I really believe in my heart of hearts today, a lot of this stuff could be neutralized, but it's being used politically. And if we really learn the lessons, the ones that you learned through what you've gone through and what you've studied, that a lot of these things that are going on today don't have to go on today. But if you throw it into the political arena, it's going to get used to garner votes. You separate, then you got somebody on your side.
Well, you know, obviously, since I look at the through a political lens the entire time, that kind of informs the way I think about this interplay between race and politics. And yeah, certainly there have, for a long time, there have been moments that get twisted, that get used for political purposes different than they probably should have. With respect to your point about the South, what's emerging actually in as part of kind of the what the standard interpretation of the Southern strategy for the Republican Party really has been prior to my book is that this is really kind of a Richard Nixon thing, and it's a backlash thesis, rejection of the civil rights movement, and not just in the South, but shockingly to many. You said you graduated high school in 1960.
Yeah.
So that a lot of those attitudes that might have been more openly expressed in, say, Texas, the way your buddy talked about, by 1968, they're saying the same things in Milwaukee, in Gary, in other places where there had been a heavy influx of African Americans. And that's one of George Wallace's kind of aha moments when he's campaigning, really a fledgling effort for the presidency. But he notices as long as he doesn't use the N-word in the North, he can talk about many of the same things, and blue-collar people in the North in particular respond much in the same way as blue-collar people in the South. And so this has really caused a lot of scholars to question even more things. And in my book, I just try to say, look, it's not as if in 1968 the Republican Party figured out that there was territory south of the Mason-Dixon line that they might get some following in, and that they'd been making efforts for more than 100 years by the time, well, around 100 years by the time Richard Nixon is there.
Yeah, no question about it. And I really believe that if we would just, if we could, and I don't think, Ted, it's a possibility, if we could get the politics out of this, I think a lot of these things can get straightened out, and it wouldn't matter what party that you were in, because we're in a situation right now that I have never in my lifetime seen a separation like we have today. Even when the tremendous amount of overt, overt racism was going on, and remember the days when Sammy Davis Jr., as popular as he was, he couldn't play in certain nightclubs because of his color. That said, that went on. It doesn't go on today. But I believe most of the problems that we have today, and I'll tie it right back to politics.
Well, with the parties and the division, I'll tell you this. It's not fun to live through, but it sure is fun to study in the past. Because at the beginning of my study in 1877, talk about polarization. I mean, this is, you know, guns drawn on either side, as the Republican Party is arguing strenuously that its candidate, Rutherford B. Hayes, was duly elected. Democratic Party, with Samuel Tilden, arguing, no, our candidate is the one who won that contested election of 1876. And the memories of the Civil War continued and persisted. And so I think actually there has been a time as divided as our own. There may have been two or three. It's just none of us alive, nobody alive, has seen a kind of polarization that is both party and regionally based the way we currently have, where it's so stark, where there seems to be so little middle ground, and that is frustrating for people.
The book in and of itself, we're starting to run out of time, but your book in and of itself, I read it page by page, cover to cover, The Door of Hope. What do I, Michael Ray, get from that book? Well, what's my takeaway? What do I walk away with, Ted, that I didn't have before I read the book?
I think, number one, Michael Ray, that you walk away with a deeper appreciation of how party affiliation can change over time. I hope you would walk away with a sense of contingency, an idea that either party did not have to end up the way it is today, that discrete choices were made at certain times. With respect to the story that I'm telling, that meant the Republican Party prioritizing certain groups in the South at the expense of others. And I think one of the things you'd see is this kind of tragic middle position. After 1876, with Reconstruction over, the Republican Party realizes it can't enforce its policies by military force. But by 1933, has really found no satisfactory way to live up to its legacy as the party of Lincoln and yet also remain a viable national force, meaning having a following that didn't know sectional boundaries. And the way that plays out largely was at the expense of African Americans, but it's a rich, compelling story that I hope you would realize is just, you know, far more nuanced, complicated, and fascinating than anybody would have thought.
Ted, by the way, thank you so much for your time. And I really believe if more and more people like yourself put to pen what you found out, maybe over a period of time, people would start to look at our world and the way we live in our world and the way we do things in our world just a bit differently. Now, by the way, is there a website?
I certainly hope so. I hope I would agree with that. That is part of the reason many of us do what we do.
By the way, is there a website we can find you at to buy the book?
The book is on Amazon. It's also at the University Press of Florida's website. Those are the two best places really to find it. And so that would be where I would point people who are interested in reading it.
Wonderful. Hey, Ted, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on, Michael Ray.
Take care. Good night.
Where's old Maggie Heath? So there's never, never.
never a trace of red dot left. Then they swing on a sidewalk. Sunday morning, don't you know? Lies about it, just oozing life. Heep! And someone sneaking round the corner. Tell me, could that someone be Mac the Knife? Oh, there's a tugboat coming down by the river, don't you know? Well, cement bags just hanging on down. Oh, that cement is there strictly for the weight, dear. Five will get you 10. Old Mackey's back in town. Yeah, hey, about Louis Miller. He done disappeared, dear. After drawing out, feels good. All his hard-earned cash. And now Mackey, he spends just like a shaver. Could it be our boy's done something rash? Come on, come on. Send me Dada, ho, 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 Suki Tawdry. Hello, Miss Lottie Linya. Good evening, Lucy Brown. Over line forms way on the right bay. And now that Mackie's back in old L.A. town. Diver, look out, Suki Tawdry. Stay back, Lottie Linya. Move it over, Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms way on the right bay. And now that Mackie's back in town.
And so are we. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Don Tapscott back with us. He's one of the world's leading authorities on innovation, media, and the economic and social impact of technology, and advises business and government leaders around the world. He has authored and co-authored 14 widely read books, including the 1992 bestseller Paradigm Shift, 1995 hit The Digital Economy, Changed Thinking Around the World About the Transformational Nature of the Internet, and 2 years later, he defined the net generation and the digital divide in growing up digitally. And let us say, Don, hey, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be here, as it were.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, when we take a look at the world today, I know you look at it through not just selected eyes, you look at it in a very broad base with your background and how you see things. When we look at the world economy today, it's more than just the economy's down, the money is short, and people are frightened. There's an underlying current. There's a something that drives this. Through your eyes, Don, what do you see? Where do you see us going, and why do you see us in the place we are?
Well, you've been reading my new book, Macro Wikinomics, and I'm thankful for that. I think we're at a turning point in history. This is not some kind of this is not partisan cycle. It's a secular change that the industrial age and many of its institutions finally run out of gas. And everything from our old models of government, the corporation, the way we innovate, newspapers are going bankrupt. 70 have gone under in the U.S. Our old models of science, the pharmaceutical industry, for example, is about to lose 40% of its revenue. Because of its old model. We've got ancient models of the university and of education and of global problem solving. In all of these, we've also got the contours of a set of sparkly new initiatives that show how we can rebuild these institutions around the Internet and around a whole new set of principles. So I'm actually not discouraged at all by the global situation. I'm quite upset. If we're going to fix what ails the world, we need to start by knowing what the problem is. And the problem is not that we have a long business cycle.
But, Don, it's the implementation of the program. I think that's where our stall is. There's tremendous amount of money still around the planet. There's a lot of money still here in the United States also. People are just a little bit frightened to put it out there to create whatever it is because they're not sure what's going to come next. But the internet, yes, but there's got to be, and that's the, we could call that the delivery system. But there's got to be that force behind it that has the foresight to be able to set us in the direction that we need to come back. So we have to look at it politically. Any way you look at it, it comes back down to politics. Those people who run the country and run the world and the direction that they take us. How do you move through that to become a modern-day thinker?
Well, all around the world, model of politics, and there are different variants on that, but all around the world, this is failing. And it started in Tunisia 8 months ago, where you had a new generation of young people. They were told you work hard, you get a job, or you stay out of trouble, you graduate, you can have a job and a prosperous life. Well, that wasn't the truth. They came into 45% youth unemployment, and they realized they had no way of fixing it because it wasn't a real democracy. So they also, at their fingertips, had the most powerful tools ever for finding out what's going on, informing others, and organizing collective responses. And they used social media to bring down a dictatorship. And this, of course, spread across Egypt and is now in a dozen countries. Gaddafi, in some ways, was a victim of that. But the problem is not restricted to the Middle East. Youth unemployment in Spain is 42%. You're about to see the lid fly off Greece when that country defaults on its sovereign debt and all of a sudden people can't get basic services. And we've had Occupy Wall Street, Occupy this, Occupy that. And it's really easy to say, well, these are all a bunch of Urshoo mama, you know, dope-smoking hippies or something like that. But, and there may be lots of those involved, but this is reflective of something much, much deeper. And, you know, as the industrial age comes to an end, we've got to find the will to fix these problems. Otherwise, where there will be very profound social disruption all around the world. And well, the previous transition between agrarian feudal societies and industrial capitalism of 100 years ago, 200 even years ago, that was punctuated by revolutions. So the stakes are very high, and I agree, in finding the leadership to bring about this kind of change.
Let me tell you what my biggest concern is, and obviously we see what's going on with the anti-Wall Street, the anti-this, the anti-that, and I'm starting to watch some of these kids. They don't look any different than what you'll see with riots in France and so on and so forth. But my main concern basically is this. There's not a commonality of thought. There's not the collaboration of thought to one idea that somebody's against something. Every one of them so far, when they've been interviewed off the street, it's, why are you here? Well, because we can't get a job. Corporations steal our jobs. Well, if a corporation could give you a job, would you go to work? Oh, no, I wouldn't go to work for them because they steal jobs. The point is they're demonstrating, and they should demonstrate. We have the right to demonstrate. But I really believe in my heart of hearts, deep down, there's no central focus to move forward. And right now, they're wasting their time.
Well, that's in part because of two things. One is that we're in the early stages of all this, and it hasn't crystallized around some clear demand. But the other thing is that there are a multiplicity of real problems that people are unhappy about, and they're all linked. You know, the data that just came out yesterday about the growing disparity between haves and have-nots in the United States, this is like at the greatest point since the Depression. We've got, you know, the rich are absolutely getting richer, and everybody else is declining. And there's a real sense that corporations are not acting in the interest of society. You know, you look at the banks. We give the banks license to operate to do certain things in society. The banks don't exist purely to make money for their shareholders. They perform functions. They enable people to lend or to borrow money and to have a safe place to put money. They should be lending money to small companies. They should be being considerate of our interests, but the banks have not been doing that. Their core modus operandi of Wall Street almost brought down global capitalism. So, and there's also a real sense that it's not just these big class divisions in society that are growing, but that people can't, it's similar to Tunisia in some ways. People in Egypt and Syria and Yemen and everything else, I mean, you got dictatorships there, and we don't have a dictatorship in America or in the developed world, but there's a growing feeling that we can't do much about this. It doesn't really matter who gets elected. The government seems paralyzed, unable to think. In fact, they have this cozy relationship, whoever they are, with really powerful forces like banks. So these are not really clear demands, but there's a certain consistency amongst the concerns that are being raised. You know what? There's 21% youth unemployment in the United States. This is intolerable. People call it a jobless recovery. That's like, I can't stand that term. That's like an oxymoron, you know? It's like a scented deodorant or jumbo shrimp or military music or something like that. I mean, this is a contradiction in terms. And if we don't fix this, what we're seeing today is going to make, is just the beginning, and it's going to make the big youth upsurges of the 1960s look like kids stuff.
Oh, sure. But, Don, we're going to talk about a word, and it's a very interesting word, and that word is called entitlement. We're seeing more and more and more of this, and government's going to take care of you, and the rich guy is the bad guy, and that's not necessarily so. Corporations have had some problems, but everybody is not a Bernie Madoff. And the problem here is this. If you take somebody who is running a large corporation, give them a good salary, give them perks, give them whatever they want, because they're the people that are creative enough to expand it, to create jobs, to do all of the things that they're supposed to do. But you tax them to death, they're going to start moving out of the country. They're starting to do it now. California alone, there are businesses that are moving out because they can't deal with the taxation. And it gets to a point now where people are getting frightened to death. And I think the government is scaring people, which doesn't do anybody any good. And people, quote unquote, don't know where the next dollar is coming from. And the problem, and I'm going to repeat it again, there's still a tremendous amount of money here. People are just afraid to let it go. If you talk about the nation average of about a 9.1, 9.2 unemployment rate, it's not good. But there's also, what about the 89% of the people that are employed? We don't talk about that.
Well, you just raised a lot of issues there. And I'll start with the question of entitlement. Are people who work hard, go to school, stay out of trouble, graduate, entitled in this wealthiest economy in the world to have an opportunity for employment? I think they are.
Yes.
That they absolutely are. Are they entitled to share in the wealth that they create? Now, are they entitled to have a government that acts in their interest, not in the interests of some small group? I'll tell you about taxing the rich. I mean, this is beyond my area of expertise, really. I'm a humble social media guy who talks about the impact of social media on society, but I got to say, there's somebody who disagrees with you, and his name is Warren Buffett.
Yeah, well, look how much Buffett owes the government that he's not paying.
The tax rates in the United States for people like him are embarrassingly low compared to all other countries around the world, in the developed world.
Don, it's over 50%. I mean, it really, when you think about that, maybe his personal tax could be 50%+, but what about the taxation when you're dealing with a lot of these companies that are trying to stay in business, but now they've got health care jammed down their throat? They can't afford that. They're starting to let people go. You're right back on the we're in trouble again and the unemployment. Buffett is Buffett, and Buffett owes a ton of money to the government, IRS, and he hasn't paid it yet.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, you make the case that these people that are, you know, being paid horrific amounts of money in the banking industry and on Wall Street deserve it because they're the ones who are creating real value in the economy. How do you create real value by creating a bunch of funds based on derivatives where you pay yourself personal income, as one guy did last year, $4 billion.
Yeah,
how
that's
is
one
that
guy.
Helping the economy? Well, that's not one guy. It's happening all over the place that there are people who are not creating any value, actual value. They're just moving money around that doesn't create any actual value in the economy. They get paid a lot. Meanwhile, people everywhere are losing their homes. There's 50 million people who don't have health care, who are afraid of sick. There's another 50 million who have terribly bad health care. This is embarrassing. Yeah. There are lots of countries in the world that aren't as rich as the United States where everybody's covered and everybody has great health care.
But Don, let's
fundamentally wrong, and there's a growing sense of that.
Well, let's bring it back to basics. These insurance companies here in the United States, they can't do business in every state. Florida, it's an arm and a leg to get insurance, and a lot of the insurance companies can't get in there. What's wrong with the free market society? What's wrong with that? And let every insurance company do business in every state, get into a competitive situation. Now you got the price down, and people are covered because they've got to give them the best for the least amount, or they're going to lose the customer. That's capitalism. But that's capitalism.
Well, there's a lot better way of doing it. Most countries in the world, wealthy countries, have a single payer. In a country like States, that 20% of its GDP goes to healthcare, and there's 100 million people not covered or undercovered, and they're all the problems that you speak to. Meanwhile, you've got countries like Britain and Canada and so on, where healthcare is covered for everybody and at half the cost of to the GDP. So would we move more towards free market principles when we know from the experience around the world that there are much more effective ways of delivering better health care at a fraction of the cost of all these insurance companies with their individual overheads and all of their marketing campaigns and all their weird incentive systems? I mean, there are just better ways to do this. And markets don't fix everything. If there's anything we should have learned from the last 3 years, it's that we let these people function in a free market. So what did they do? Well, they gave loans to subprime mortgage loans to countless people who they knew would have no ability to pay. And then they knew in 4% of the cases that these people would never make the first payment. Then they bundled them up into a derivative of collateralized debt obligation. And then they got rating agencies that they pay to rate them. And then they got insurance companies to rate them. Rating agencies rated them AAA. Insurance companies insured them. Then they sold them to all these unwitting investors who had no idea what they were buying. And should the whole thing go south, they implemented something called a credit default swap that made sure they'd make money if the whole thing collapsed. That's your free market for you.
Yeah, but there's also somebody called Acorn that got into some of these areas and forced some of these bankers to give loans that they shouldn't have given in the first place. Yes, then we had the problem. No question about it. And then they sold it and they packaged it and the package became another package. And by the time they were done, if you just pick a number, if you had a half a billion dollar package, truly it was only worth a couple $300,000. And when it fell apart, it was almost like what do I want to say? It was almost like I lost the word I want.
Wouldn't you agree that there's a growing sense that all the people who did this, actually none of them went to jail. None of them were really punished at all. And they're all saying, hey, let's get back in the saddle again. It's time to start issuing the big bonuses. And the core modus operandi of the financial services industry that almost brought down global capitalism hasn't changed a bit.
No, by the way,
John, it's not going to happen again next year.
We're starting to run out of time. I would love to have you come back on the show. Let me get Susie to get a hold of you. And if you got time, let's spend some more time with this. I can probably talk to you all night about this stuff. And there are just so many things.
Well,
that
these are actually my sort of opinions as an individual. They're not really my point of view as a business strategist and an advisor to government on these issues. Well, in macroeconomics, we describe positively what needs to be done to turn this situation around.
Now, by the way, the website we can find you at and buy the book.
Yep, macroeconomics.com. Or you can go to just dontapscott.com, or I'm on Twitter, at dtapscott.
Wonderful. Hey, Don, thank you so much for joining us. It's fun when you're on. And by the way, we should all have opinions. The day we don't, then we might as well just give up.
Well, it was a good discussion. Thanks very much.
Okay, take care. Good night.
Okay, bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return.
Charlie Eichner with us. He is the author. He's the author of The Writing Code, the only writing guide you'll ever need. The only brain-based system to master writing and editing fields, all editing fields. He's a longtime teacher, and he's an author. He's written books about baseball, presidential politics, urban politics, and planning, protest, and social movements, and civil rights. His latest book is Nobody Turned Me Around, A People's History of the 1963 March on Washington. He's also the creator of, again, The Writing Code, the only brain-based system for mastering writing at all levels. And let us say, Charlie, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. Nice talking to you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, writing is interesting. I'm going to line it up with reading just for a moment. There were so many people who thought they knew how to read. They knocked phonics out years and years and years ago. They had a new way to teach it. And then the phonics game came back into existence, and there were more people who realized that they didn't know how to read. It was either too slow, they'd fall asleep, they'd do something. So when people hear reading and writing, they just leave it at that, but there's so much more, isn't there?
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought up the phonics question, because that really is kind of a similar dilemma that I faced when I was putting together The Writing Code, because phonics teaches you how to write by getting at the basics, at the phonemes, the sounds that are created by different combinations of letters. And that really is the kind of atomic level of learning how to read. And once you learn phonics, you can really put together sounds and ideas in any kind of combination. It really is the kind of master key to reading. And when I put together The Writing Code, I was really looking for a kind of similar master key to understand all this. And that's why I went and did all this research on the brain and on learning. And at the time, I was also teaching writing at Yale and working on a book. And I really wanted to kind of figure out what is the code, what is that master key that will get us in the way that phonics helps readers get into that world.
Now, are we talking about, and we know the brain is an electrochemical factory, and based on experience, creates an emotion. The emotion creates a behavior and releases chemicals. And this allows us to experience life the way we experience it. So what I'm hearing you say, and stop me if I'm wrong, Charlie, when you're writing, the same thing happens. It's the same process.
Yeah, well, writing is really a process of interaction with the world. It's a conversation. It's a way of creating meaning. It's a way of creating connection with something else. it's different from speaking, because when you're speaking, you have somebody who is reacting to you. But nonetheless, there is an audience, and you have to figure out who that audience is and how to read it, and also how to provoke it, how to engage it emotionally, how to break down complex ideas into simple, more understandable, more familiar ideas. And so writing is really just, part of the long continuum of human activities that involve people interacting with people. And if you can understand how the brain works, I love how you put that, the electrochemical machine. I think that's terrific. If you can figure out how that machine works, and if you can figure out what overwhelms people, what confuses people, what excites people, what arouses people, what confuses people, if you can figure all that out, then you can start to put together a system for learning how to write well every time.
Okay, so in essence, realistically, if we understand the dynamic, quote-unquote, of language, the dynamic of the brain, you tie the two together and you make sure that you got homeostasis. You make sure that you've got balance. You make sure that the word that you say has a corresponding image that your audience is going to recognize.
Mm-hmm. Well, think about it this way. Some researchers estimate that we have about 50,000 thoughts a day. And when you think of it, most of the thoughts that we have are kind of trivial, like, where did I put my keys? And I hope I make it to work on time. And I hope there's not too much traffic. And this coffee is too bitter. And trivial thoughts like that. And thank goodness we don't spend too much time thinking about them, or else our minds would explode. But the fact is that we have an endless stream of thoughts all day, and our brain basically screens out as many of those thoughts as possible so we can concentrate on tasks with our working brain. And so when you understand that, you realize that the purpose of writing is twofold. One, it's to create a kind of predictable space where people can get oriented to whatever it is you're trying to write, whether it's a business email, or it's a thriller novel, or it's a complicated explanation of a technical process. Whatever it is, you need a kind of stable ground to operate on. But you also need to break the normality. You need to kind of break the tedium of whatever it is you're involved with surprises and suspense and action and details that arouse the brain. And so the real challenge of writing and, the real challenge of all communication is to create a playing ground, if you will, that everybody can feel comfortable and everybody can feel a certain amount of predictable and reliable activity, but also that once in a while, when you have something really important to say or when you have something that you really want to arouse and connect the reader with, you do surprise them, you do connect with them, so those ideas stand out from the other 50,000 more trivial ideas that you have all day.
So in essence, and stop me if I'm wrong here, in essence what I'm hearing you say, and then we'll ask for a practical the practical application of it, but what I'm hearing you say basically, it's not, when you talk about brain-based system, it's not the person who's writing, it's knowing the response of the person who's reading, because they're the brain chemistry can be changing based on the words and what the dynamic and the meaning of the word are.
That's, something. I'm so glad you said it, and I'm so glad you said it the way you did, because that's exactly right. When I'm working with my students, sometimes I tell them, and I do this a little bit to be provocative, but I tell them, look, I don't really care about you. I do personally. You're a terrific person, and I like being with you. But really, the only person who matters in this equation is the reader. And we, the writers, are the servants of the reader. And we have to do their bidding. We have to understand what their state of mind is, what they bring to the conversation, what it is that's going to make things confusing, what it is that's going to make things exciting. And if we can truly have empathy and understanding for the reader and the reader's situation, then we're going to write a lot better. When you look at books that came out 100 or 150 years ago, they tended to be a lot more dense and they tended to be a lot more meandering than the writing of publications these days. And it's because the reader was in a different situation. The reader was much more of an elite, and reading itself was much more of a kind of total activity. You could truly get away from it all because there wasn't as much to get away from. But the reader in the modern times is so distracted and so overwhelmed with information that we have to be cognizant of that, and we have to give the reader the kind of material that's going to be best suited for the kind of crazy lifestyles that we have in the modern age.
Oh, sure. And what it boils down to is the people that you're trying to communicate with, to sell, to reach, to teach, for whatever reason, they don't really, and I'm saying the same thing you are in a different way, they don't care about you, don't even care about what you have to offer until they know how what you have can benefit them. They've got to recognize,
absolutely,
I think that's an important word, recognize the perceived value for them inside your message. And what it comes down to, it's not what you do, quote unquote, it's what you can do for me.
That's right. And you know, you could look at value in different ways. I know you were looking at it very broadly, but it could be everything from, you know, pure information that you get in a business memo to a different kind of value that you get when you're reading a novel like The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest or something like that. But you're right. It's a matter of kind of what can you do for me? What can you tell me that I don't already know? And what can you do to excite me in this limited period of time that I'm going to give to you to read your stuff?
I really believe what it boils down to, and I've played with this for years and years and years now. I'll do this rhetorically. Set up a scenario. You're doing a project at home. You want a hole in the wall. So you go down to the hardware store to get a drill, which is going to make the hole. And the question I will normally ask is, what are you buying, the drill or the hole? Most people end up saying they're buying the drill, but it's not. You're buying what the drill can do for you, which happens
That's
to be
right.
the hole. That's what
That's
they're
right.
buying. People will not
right.
set buy your books. They won't buy your products. They won't buy your service. They won't buy you. What they'll buy is what it has to do with them, what it can do for them, and most importantly, how they feel about it. And then when you take it beyond the feeling, there's so much more to that statement than just words. There's an entire internal dynamic that occurs which brings about the feeling response, a predetermined audience reaction. What you say and how you say it will bring about intentional responses. So I would imagine it's the same thing that would happen when you're speaking or you're writing. What you say, how you say it, is going to create the response you're looking for. You know ahead of time what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, but the only difference being is that when you're speaking in an auditorium or in a classroom or in a living room, you can see how your audience is responding. So if they look kind of puzzled, you can adjust your language or you can track back and explain it again in a different way. But when you're writing for the invisible reader, you don't know how they're reacting. So you have to kind of put yourself in their position and kind of anticipate when they might get confused, when they might get overwhelmed, when they might be a little uncertain about what you're saying. And so, you know, I just read a recent interview with Kurt Vonnegut before he died, and he was talking with Robert Caro, the author of the great biographies of Robert Moses and Lyndon Johnson. And Vonnegut said something really interesting. He said, writing is the only art form where we demand intense participation by the audience. And so when you think about it, we're really asking our readers to not only give us the money to buy our book or newspaper or magazine and the time to read it, but we're asking for the most kind of precious resource, which is their brain power, their intense physical and emotional and intellectual involvement in kind of co-creating our product. And when you start to appreciate the reader in that way, I think you're going to write in a different way than if you think about writing as just something for yourself.
Okay, now, by the way, I can't speak to writing. I'm not a professional with it. I can speak to speaking. And I've authored a book, and it basically I use the same process. It's got to be something that's recognizable to that audience. If it's about me, you got
right.
me, I'm going to listen to you. And
right.
realistically, I believe, and I've seen this, whether it's got to do with writing, got to do with speaking, whatever the case may be, there's something called a predictable emotional response. You know what the answer is based on you have two audiences out there. You got a target audience, you're that ideal person that you're looking for, and your regular audience. Your regular audience, your general audience, you're not going to hit them anyway. But that person that you're looking for, if you know what it is that they're interested in and not what you have can fix it, that's when you've got the attention. And I believe in writing, it would have to be the same thing. I've got a solution to your problem, and I can fix it, and you start to recognize it, and then I keep you.
Now, the other interesting thing And there's a wonderful book. You might want to talk to this guy sometime. Daniel Willingham is a psychologist at the University of Virginia. And he wrote a wonderful book called Why Students Don't Like School. And in this book, he talks about what the whole teaching and learning process is. And he said at one point, and I quote this often, he said, all learning is really just remembering. And what you're doing when you're learning, and I think the same thing goes with writing, is you are kind of recalling information that you already had, but just dressing it up a little bit or deploying it in a slightly different way. And
yeah.
And so that's what the writer has to do also. He has to kind of have an idea of what the reader already knows, and then make, you know, tap into that existing knowledge to provide new information or new insights. And so there really is a kind of whole psychology here of the relationship between the reader and writer, just like there's a relationship between the student and the teacher.
Oh, no question about it. And by the way, I am not a writer, and I love everything that you're saying right now. I have been a student for years, and as long as I've been on the air, which has been more years than I want to tell you, that every night it's a learning process, and I think mm-hmm. that's really key. But when it boils down to it, Charlie, when it comes down with either speaking or writing, whatever the case may be, if it's about me, I'm going to hear you, I'm going to listen to you. And if you know your target audience and you talk about your predictable emotional responses, things that you know that target audience is going to be interested in because there's a recognition of something familiar in their past mm-hmm. that now it's not the what you're writing there you're talking about. They see themselves in it.
Right. Well, yeah. there's another element of this also. I mean, we've talked a little bit about content. You know, you have to understand what your audience already knows, you know, whether it's whether it's about sports or politics or philosophy or economics or whatever the case might be. But it's also the kind of form that you convey this information. Let me give you a quick example. There are three basic ways that we perceive the world. I mean, there's more, but these are the big three. And it's visual, auditory, and kinesthetic. In other words, seeing, hearing, and touching, feeling. Everybody has a different bias. I tend to be more of a visual perceiver than a couple of my friends who are more kinesthetic or bodily perceivers. And there's other people who tend to kind of hear things more. Now, if you write, if I were to write completely with my bias, my kind of sensory bias, and I did everything in visual terms, I would be kind of ignoring the needs, you know, the kind of learning needs or the communication needs of the kinesthetic and auditory readers out there. And so I have to be really careful to make sure that I use words that not only kind of show people what I'm describing, but also that help people to hear what I'm describing and kind of feel or touch what I'm describing as well. And you know, it's just a matter of being conscious, as you said so well before, of the needs of the audience. If all the world perceive the world visually like I do, I wouldn't have to worry about it much. But in fact, visual is just one of the three major ways of perceiving the world. So I have to kind of serve the people who experience the world auditorily and also kinesthetically. So it's the way you convey the information as well as the, you know, the content of the information as well.
There's also a way to capture both of them at the same time. And in not necessarily writing, but that's not my expertise. I can't mm-hmm. speak to that. But in verbal conversation, if I say to you, chamber around, do you know what that means?
No.
Okay. All right. So you don't have any kind of an image for it, do you?
No, I don't.
Okay. But if I said to you, put a bullet in a gun, you see that now, don't you?
I do. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Chamber Good. Around, put a bullet in a gun. But if it's right. not familiar right. to you, you're not going to have an image or corresponding image for the word. So very
right.
simply put, a little story or an illustration after what you said, you catch both left and right brain thinkers, auditory,
right.
you catch all three of them.
Yep. That's absolutely right. And
just
and
a thought.
It's a really good point. And you know, what I try to get my students to do, whether I'm in a seminar with business people or I'm in a classroom at a college or a university, what I try to get them to do is very consciously pay attention to these senses. One of the things that I like to do is I'll give out an article. Like one of my favorite articles for teaching purposes is a wonderful profile by Elizabeth Gilbert called Lucky Jim. Elizabeth Gilbert's the author of Eat, Pray, Love, as you probably know. But she wrote this magnificent profile of a guy named Jim McLaren who had been paralyzed and was kind of trying to make sense of his life and give his life meaning after his paralysis. But I give the article out, and I say, take out a Sharpie and mark every word that affects you physically. And so they do that. And what they realize kind of for the first time in a lot of cases is that writing is a really physical activity. They don't realize it all the time, but every time there's a word that kind of chops at you or slashes at you or makes sounds or produces feelings or images, it affects your body. It literally affects your body. And that's a really great thing to keep in mind, because if you cannot arouse your reader, if you cannot arouse your audience, you're probably going to lose your audience. And then likewise, if you arouse it too much, your audience is going to get exhausted. And so one of my strategies that I teach is what I call yo-yoing. And I say what we need to do is move back between the kind of really sensory language that you find in scenes and in action. We need to move from that to less sensory writing that you find in backgrounds and descriptions and context. And so we yo-yo back and forth. We move back and forth between scene and summary. And therefore, we give the reader the action that it needs, but also the rest and the reprieve from the action that it also needs. Because writing, like everything else in life, is physical. And we have to kind of understand that the body craves action, but it also needs a break from the action once in a while, too.
Charlie, unless you're old enough and we don't crave action, you get older. Charlie, we're just about out of time. Can we? And by the way, it's been wonderful having you on. Do you have a website we can find you at and get the book?
You bet. It's called thewritingcodesystem.com.
Wonderful. And by the way, Charlie, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time. It's been a great segment.
Anytime. Talk to you soon.
Take care.
Bye.
Good night.
How's you know, honey? You always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in, wrong, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only. Cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Laura Schwab with us. She's the co-author of An Invisible Thread, the true story of an 11-year-old panhandler and a busy sales executive and an unlikely meeting with destiny. She's a former advertising executive who's worked with several major media companies, including Time Inc., Condé Nast, born and raised in Long Island, Laura was part of the advertising team that made USA Today a successful national newspaper, and before helping launch three of the most successful startups in Time Inc. history, InStyle, Teen People, and People Style Watch. She was also the New York division manager at People Magazine. Laura has also been the New York ad manager at Ms. Magazine and associate publisher at Brides. And she loves spending time in her condo on Long Island, and visiting her family in New York. Laura, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Did I say Long Island right?
It's Long. Yeah, you said it right. Long Island.
Long Island. No, I have a little bit of it with it. By the way, thank you for being here. And number one, the 11-year-old panhandler and the busy executive, which is you, meeting with destiny. What happened? What started this entire thing?
Well, it's very simple. I came outside, was starting to walk up 56th Street. An 11-year-old panhandler in burgundy sweats said, "Excuse me, lady, I'm hungry. Do you have any spare change?" And I said no, and I walked away. But as I walked almost in the middle of the street of Broadway, I realized what he said, which was, "I'm hungry."
Yeah.
And I stopped and turned around and went back and said, "You know what? If you're really hungry, I'll take you over to McDonald's, and I'll get you something to eat."
Did you go to McDonald's?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I looked, came back, and I said to him, "Listen, if you're really hungry, I'll take you out to get you something to eat." And he looked at me, and he smiled. So we went to McDonald's together. I told him I wanted to join him. And after McDonald's, I was intrigued by him. He had the sweetest and warmest eyes. Said, "Do you want to go for a walk in the park?" So he said, "Sure." And then when we got done, we were passing Häagen-Dazs. I said, "Would you like some chocolate ice cream?" And he looked at me and smiled and said, "Designer ice cream?" So I said, "Sure." And then he said to me, "Do you like to play video games?" So I said, "Yeah, I like video games." And we went and played some video games. And then we went our separate ways. But I gave him my business card and said, "If you're ever hungry," I said, "call me. I'll be happy to buy you dinner."
You know, when it really comes down to it, and Laura, if more people would just listen to what people are saying underneath the words. Now, obviously, it went farther than that. But the point of contention is those chance meetings can change a person's entire life. Had you said no and walked away, I would not be sitting here with this book in my hand. The message would not go out to millions of people, and it doesn't stop from there. It's basically a legacy. And that's what we get for not just listening, but hearing it underneath the words and taking the time and stopping and doing something for someone. That we live in such a microwavable, fast-paced society, we don't pay attention anymore.
Right. And actually, when he said it to me, I really wasn't paying attention. It took me a few minutes for it to actually register what he said.
Yeah.
Now, I could have kept walking, but we do believe that, you know, we were destined to meet, that, you know, it was really kind of fate that brought us together.
Okay, now, but where was the change in your life because of him? What'd you learn about you and life?
Well, you know, the change in my life was I was at a point in my life where I was doing pretty well in advertising, but there was a certain, I felt there was something really lacking. And what Maurice gave to me, a job or success couldn't. It was the ability to care about somebody and have that person care about you. So he was really, for me, like this unforeseen blessing that was just kind of put in my path. And he changed my life drastically.
Now, how long ago was this?
This was 25 years ago. In fact, we just celebrated our 25th anniversary. It was September 1st, 1986.
Well, now, with him, what changes happened in his life because of that meeting?
Maurice, do you want to answer that?
Oh, he's there.
Well, hi, this is Maurice Mazak.
Oh, Maurice, hi. I didn't realize you were there. Thank you so much for being here. I would have talked to you also. Thank you for being here. Go, Maurice.
Okay, the changes that happened in my life because of our meeting was drastic, because at the time, you know, I'd planned to be a drug dealer within the next couple of weeks to days at 11. Well, I was 12 at the time, but I had planned to become a drug dealer within the next couple of weeks because, you know, times were getting too rough, and that's all I knew. And so the change happened because of a person caring for me so much, that showing me so much, that I had to realize what I knew was wrong.
Maurice, when it comes down to it, a simple act like a hamburger can change an entire life. And I really believe when kids go, when they start drug dealing and getting into gangs and so on and so forth, if you're not getting what you need at home, the acceptance and the feeling of family, and which gives you identity at home, you're going to go out and look for it someplace else. And the acceptance that you got from Laura was that acceptance unconsciously that you were looking for, that the drug dealing and the rest of it could have given you. And it was just, you know, one hamburger, one simple, yeah, I'm gonna be here for you, changed an entire life. And I wonder how many lives the both of you will change because of your story.
Well, what's really nice is that there is really that trickle-down effect, because not only really has Maurice changed my life, but in many ways I've changed his lives. And because of how our lives have changed, his children's lives are changing. So we already see that, you know, having that trickle-down effect.
Well, but let's take it a step farther.
Yeah.
Without the hamburger, he might not have had any children today.
Right.
He might not even be alive today.
That's definitely one of the things that I always say. Had without that hamburger and without that kind gesture that Laura's shown and given me, I honestly believe, and this is my honest belief, I believe either one, I'd be in prison for the rest of my life right now, or two, I'd be dead.
Yeah. Yeah, no question about it. And it's just that simple act of kindness. And it comes at those times. I don't believe in accidents. I really truly believe in my heart of hearts, things were meant to be. You guys, you were supposed to be there, and she was supposed to be there at that particular time. And when the time goes on, when you're both not here, and the book is here, and the legacy is here, someone's life can be changed 100 years from now because of that one act of kindness.
Well, you know, that's a really, really wonderful thought. And if there is anything that we're able to do with our book, is to also change the perceptions of how people view people who are really on the streets, particularly children. You know, here's this child. He was 11 when I met him, and he hadn't eaten for 2 days.
Mm.
You know, now, I didn't know he hadn't eaten for 2 days, but, you know, just as many New Yorkers did pass him by, I stopped. Now, you know, why did I stop? I'm not really sure, other than the fact that he said he was hungry. But again, I just kind of feel that, you know, we were really kind of meant to be. We were meant to meet. Our lives were meant to change.
Yeah. No, absolutely. No question of it. Maurice, if you could go all the way back, if you can go all the way back, when she offered the hamburger, what'd you feel like? And I don't mean that the typical, how did you feel? That's not where I'm at. What was inside of you? What brightened up? What was it that caused you to move forward with her?
What I felt was, thank God I'm getting ready to eat.
Yeah. yeah.
I say that with no pun intended. I really believe that I was really hungry that day. I mean, and the facts are, I was hoping and I was praying that someone would come and take me to get something to eat.
Yeah.
Was my prayer answered? Yes. But a little simple gesture, or you know, I didn't pray like the normal people at that time. I was hoping and then hoping, you know, my hopes were prayers. I was hoping that someone would take me to get something to eat, but I didn't know that her gesture of getting me something to eat would change my whole direction and path of life and the course of my existence at that point.
Did you have the chance in the last 25 years to be able to give someone else, you give someone a hamburger.
Definitely. I have two nieces right now in my life that one of my nieces, her mom passed away a few years back, and she was living in a similar situation as I. She was given to her other aunt who was a drug addict, and her situation was pretty grim. I've taken her in from down south, all the way from down south. I called her father. I got legal guardianship over her, and now she's doing very well in school, you know, and she's eating every day. She was in the same predicament. She didn't know when her next meal would come from. But right now, she's living very comfortably.
Wonderful. Guys, we're just about out of time. Laura, do you have a website we can find you at, buy the book, find out more?
Oh, that would be wonderful. Yes, we do. And our website is www.aninvisiblethread.com.
Wonderful. Hey, both of you, thank you so much, Laura and Maurice, for being on. What a wonderful story. And everybody who hears the story should go out and buy somebody a hamburger.
Okay.
Definitely. And thank you. Thanks for having us on your show.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Take care. Good night, guys.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Off comes the makeup. Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtain's fallen, the music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door. As they say in this biz, that's all there isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends,
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is
a wrap.
Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do...